We're going to get going. We don't quite have a quorum yet. When we get a quorum, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner will interrupt to officially bring the meeting to order. Welcome, gentlemen, and it's Commissioner Rotham and Deputy Commissioner Grant. If you could introduce yourselves for the records. We're going to let you go through your presentation, and we'll keep questions at the end of your, I understand, about a five-minute. No, just kidding. Go ahead with your presentation. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Mike Rothman, the Commissioner of Commerce.
And Mr. Chair, Bill Grant, the Deputy Commissioner of Commerce for the Energy Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We'll go as fast as we can. 5 minutes is...
You're fine.
I think we did this in an hour and a half the last time on Senate Energy, but we'll go quickly. In addition to Bill Grant, today we also have Kate O'Connell. She's a manager of the Energy and Resource Planning area. We also have Janet. Is Janet? Yes, Janet. Janet is here. Janet Streff, the manager of the Security Energy Office. Jeremy DeFebra, the supervisor of programs. John Pravenko is here, the director of our LIHEAP program, and Deb Pyle, the supervisor of energy facility and permitting. Many of you know these folks, but and I've recently gotten to know them in the last 3 weeks, and these are some of our top staff. They're exceptionally professional, and whenever you need assistance, we're all happy to help.
Commissioner, one second. We'll officially bring the meeting to order. Go ahead, Commissioner.
All right. Let me just give you a step back and give you a broad mission and overview. We promote reliable, affordable, and environmentally sound energy for Minnesota's citizens and businesses. I know you've already had, obviously, a few weeks, and you've seen some of our staff, but this gives you a flavor and overview presentation of the department. The Office of Energy Security advocates for the public interest before the energy regulatory bodies. It promotes energy efficiency and clean energy technologies through policy initiatives, financing programs, technical assistance, and public information. And it helps low-income Minnesotans afford energy costs through energy assistance and weatherization. We'll delve down into the details and give you sort of a layout of how the Office of Energy Security, our energy division, is parsed out. There are basically five units within the department. There's energy regulation and planning, energy facilities permitting, energy assistance, the energy assistance program, the state energy office, and reliability administration with other aspects too. We've put together this basic slide in terms of what the budget is by source. You'll see that a substantial amount of funding is from the federal government. We also have special revenue and general funds, as you can see here. In the next slide, we break it down by budget, the budget by unit. Again, this you'll see that the substantial portion of the federal funds go towards the energy assistance program, as well as to help some of the core functioning of the energy office. And then the rest of the units you can see spread out here as well. The department advocates for Minnesota's public interest to ensure that the rates utilities charge customers are fair and reasonable, that utilities' integrated resource plans consider supply and demand resources reasonably and according to Minnesota laws, and that utilities fairly consider alternatives to building new facilities. In the rate case area, the work is complex. There's significant analysis and modeling of financial, accounting, statistical, and cost allocation matters. It happens when you get up early to try and pronounce the word statistical, but in any event, it's in-depth and quite detailed. We also, in the rate case, it balances the needs of utility services with financial burden on utility customers, focusing to make sure that energy service is reliable, that costs are reasonable and fair, and to encourage conservation. With respect to resource plans and certificates of needs, plans involve 15-year plans for new generation, and the certificates are done with respect to proposed facilities. Again, these require sophisticated modeling into the size, type, and timing of energy needs, and identifying the lowest cost supply options and demand management alternatives. As an example of recent cases, this slide shows you that, in essence, there was a requested $88.9 million annual rate increase. The OES did an analysis and testified. We give you the amount of hours spent and the time spent, but also shows you what the savings are. Based on the OES recommendations, the Public Utilities Commission approved a rate increase of $27 million less than requested, which indicates to you the benefits of the small costs that the staff and time invested can yield. The Energy Facilities Permitting Unit, a separate unit in the department, develops environmental review record to support siting and routing of proposed projects in a prudent manner. It manages the permitting process for the siting or routing of large energy facilities, and it serves as the technical staff to the PUC. It's significant that it does not advocate for or against a particular project. The mission is to look at the facts and build the record for permitting and routing. To understand how much work the unit does, we put this slide together to show that there were 19 facility reviews completed in 2010, one power plant, one pipeline, 8 transmission lines, and 9 wind facilities. There are 13 current active reviews, 7 transmission lines, and 6 wind facilities. The folks in this unit are working very, very, very hard. The next slide is to give you an overview of our energy assistance program. Low-income home energy assistance program is called LIHEAP. It's funded through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and helps eligible households with energy needs by providing grants to reduce their energy burden in crisis situations. It's limited to funds for furnace repair replacement and outreach and referral. This slide is a couple weeks old, but there's a new allocation of about $7 million to add to this. So the current funding that Minnesota has received is $150.3 million as of today. There's contingency and leveraging funds is unknown at this time, but the total allocation in 2010 was $160 million. We're not sure whether or not we would get additional funding for this year, and the news yesterday is that for the coming years, the funding in this program is projected to go down for the next, not this year, but for years out. This gives you a little bit more detail in terms of what the funds go towards. This year it'll serve a record number of folks, 175,000 households. It gives benefits throughout the heating services. It helps them in a crisis, and it increases. We've been able to serve more households that need energy-related repairs. The state energy office also promotes energy efficiency and renewable energy through financing programs, technical assistance, and public information. There's the CIP program, Conservation Improvement Program. There's federal weatherization assistance, state energy and energy efficiency and conservation block grant programs, and the community-based energy development, solar rebates, energy, renewable energy production incentives. The SIP program has been here since 1982. In 2007, SIP went from a spending goal to a savings goal. What does that mean? It means now it includes energy savings from non-traditional utility conservation activities, such as increased codes and standards compliance, electric utility infrastructure improvements, and behavioral change programs. These numbers give you a sense of the significant expenditures for the state of Minnesota. But at the end of the day, efficiency and conservation is an indigenous resource that helps keep these dollars at home. Here's in this slide, we show you basically how much conservation improvement can save in terms of energy usage. First year savings from 2006 to 2009 equaled 2.1 million megawatts. The cumulative savings from 2006 to 2009 equals 4.9 million, the equivalent of a 696 million megawatt power plant. The total spending was approximately $420 million, which is a fraction of the cost of building that type of infrastructure if you would have to build a power plant of that size. The expected savings through 2015 equals 17.6 million megawatts, the equivalent of a 2,510 megawatt power plant. This goes at it from a different perspective. The first year savings from 2006 to 2009 from all natural gas utility SIP activities equals 7.4 million MCF. Cumulative savings equal to 19.1 million MCF. And expected savings through 2015 equal to 63.6 million. 46% of the annual residential consumption. And the total spending over this period has been approximately $74 million. Again, the benefits are significant. Turning to the Weatherization Assistance Program, its goal is to reduce low-income households' energy bills, sealing air leaks, insulating walls and attics, improving furnaces, and education and outreach. The services delivered statewide are through local community action programs, tribal councils, nonprofits, and community development corporations. The program is funded predominantly through federal funding, $132 million in ERA funding, federal stimulus money. At least 17,000 homes served with these funds, 12,000 households served to date, and it's created each quarter 500 to 600 jobs. We focus next on the state energy program and the energy efficiency and conservation block grants ERA funding. It's appropriated under Minnesota Laws 2009, Chapter 138. These grants, the funding goes towards residential energy efficiency rebates, wind, solar, and ground source heat pump rebates, commercial and industrial energy efficiency grants and loans, public building efficiency and renewable energy grants, and workforce development and training. There are $54 million SEP and $10 million in the efficiency and energy efficiency and conservation block grants. And in the last three quarters, just to quantify the jobs, it's 100 to 200 jobs created. On the residential side, we've broken down some of the projects. The Project Re-Energize, we have the Energy Savers Rebate. 4,000 homeowners receive rebates for energy-efficient window replacements, air sealing, attic and wall insulation, and furnace and AC replacement. Quantify that, there's $40 million of total value of work and more than 50,000 labor hours. This, under the state energy program, it's there's federal U.S. DOE formula grant. It's under a federal U.S. DOE formula grant since 1979. It funds core functions for the state energy office. For example, the renewable energy and energy efficiency technical assistance, energy code support, and the Energy Information Center. This slide gives you a sample of consumer information piece. There's a variety of this. This one is on ice dams. Ice dams, as we all know, are problems. We've got them on our house. The back of our house is two stories high. I will not go up on that. That's the overview. We'd stand for questions. We also respect your time and know that you have a lot on your agenda today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You mentioned the state energy program grants for wind, solar, and ground source heat pumps. How much funding is left in that program? How much is available for future use?
Commissioner Rotham or Deputy Commissioner Grant?
I'm just your eye candy this morning.
Mr. Lefebvre, if you could come forward and
come up and give us a sense of that.
Identify yourself for the record and give us an answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeremy DeFebvre, and I work in the State Energy Office in the Department of Commerce. The allocation for solar, wind, and ground source heat pumps under the ARRA funding was $5 million. The solar photovoltaic, we allocated $2.5 million. That is all reserved, almost all spent. Ground source heat pumps, I believe, was $1 million. Although I'll have to check that. It was in the ballpark of $1 million. We may have upped it a little bit. That is all reserved, almost all spent. We have approximately 400,000 for solar thermal, both air and hot water. There, I believe, is still a couple hundred thousand of that available, and about 400,000 or 500,000 for small wind installations, and I believe there's about 150,000 of that still available.
Follow up, Representative Anderson. Mr. Lefebvre, could I ask you, as a member of that conference committee, when we were dealing with the stimulus money, there was concern with the agency that you would be able to find enough eligible homes to qualify for all the weatherization money. I see a number of mentioned in the presentation the commissioner did of the number of homes. So were you able to find enough qualified homes to have all the spend all the money you had in the program? Mm-hmm. And then also, didn't we give you some language that allow you to move some money into some of the other areas if you weren't able? How did that, just a snapshot of how that all worked out?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. The first question, I think, largely relates to the weatherization assistance program with a significant amount of funding, $132 million versus typical annual appropriation of $10 million from the U.S. Department of Energy. We have had no difficulty in finding more than enough candidates for that. We use the same eligibility criteria and the same eligibility intake that the Energy Assistance Program does, and they're serving approximately 160,000 to 175,000 households a year. We in the past have typically been able to serve somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000, and with ARRA money, we're hoping to serve a total of approximately 17,000. So the numbers that we're able to serve are dwarfed by the numbers that are eligible. As far as other funds that we were given a capacity to reallocate, those were the state energy program funds, the $54 million that were devoted to a significant variety of both energy efficiency and renewable energy programs. We have had significant success in residential programming and in commercial industrial programming, and less success in local government and public buildings programming. We have gone through a couple of reallocation processes that are spelled out in Chapter 138. largely moving money from public buildings to commercial, industrial, and residential energy efficiency, and we are looking at that as a possibility for moving some additional funds in the near future.
Well, thank you. And just one follow-up, if I could. In regards to the homes that you've been able to help with weatherization, what would be an approximate reduction in their energy costs that they've realized from being able to get their homes better prepared for winter or summer in the case of air conditioning? Just anybody have a ballpark?
Mr. Chairman, I'm told it's approximately 30% of their energy use.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the presenters, a couple of questions. First, the state energy program, looking at the slide on the bottom of page 12, and suggestion is $40 million total value of work. These are ERA funds, I'm assuming. More than 50,000 labor hours. Does that include labor only? And I mean, if so, it looks like $80 an hour. Is that what that represents, or does it also include materials, etc.?
Mr. Lefebvre.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative, it includes both labor and materials. So that would be the total value of the work done.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski, it's $800 an hour, not $80. Mm-hmm. Representative Drazkowski, follow-up.
Oh, it's early in the morning. Thank you, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Mr. Lefebvre, is it? I've got a school in my district, Zimbrota Mazeppa, and I've been trying to find the answer to this question. The superintendent contacted me a couple of months ago and said, Steve, this gas company that we buy our gas from suddenly is including this charge on the bill. And incidentally, he began the discussion by outlining the fact that they had just weatherized their entire building, and there really wasn't anything they could do in terms of building energy efficiency. But the gas company brought this bill, and I remember the details. I remember is that it was I think it was about $2,000 for hardware and equipment, and $400 or $500 a month for some sort of ongoing phone charge or something. Can you tell us what that is? Some sort of mandate is being placed on this school, and I haven't been able to discover exactly what the source of it is.
Representative Drazkowski, we're going to use call a friend here.
Yeah. Thank you.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Kate O'Connell. Chairman, do you happen to know the name of the gas company?
Representative Drazkowski, seeing how you're on a first-name basis with the local superintendent, you probably know the name of the gas company. You know your district forward and backwards.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know the gas company, but I do know the superintendent of the school. I'm on the receiving end of the question, Mr. Chair.
Good job. Representative Drazkowski, why don't you get the agency the name of the gas company? We'd all like to hear more about this, and then if you could get back to the committee, and we'll make sure all the members get answers to Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Question. Commissioner, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, I notice on your page one, your slide, the very first thing you have is promote reliable, you know, and then you get the affordable environmental sound energy. What reliable energy sources are you discussing?
Commissioner Roth.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, all energy sources so that they are reliable. It's a goal and mission of the department and the state of Minnesota.
Commissioner, follow-up. Commissioner, I'm sorry, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner. I guess I misinterpreted that as to refer to having sufficient baseline energy to meet our needs, and that, you know, reliable is it's there whether the sun shines or the wind blows or doesn't.
Commissioner Rothman, do you care to comment on wind or solar?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to generally. I mean, you know.
You could include nuclear if you want to, Commissioner.
You know,
I think that we all first of all are debating all sorts of sources. Minnesota's needs, as the representative has indicated, it's critical to have our baseload energy met. You know, Minnesota currently, as everybody knows, is coming out of a recession. There are a variety of energy sources that Minnesota has. You know, the department has looked at the energy baseload needs, and with respect to that, you know, there is solar and wind. Generally, in my perspective, is that it's important for Minnesotans, all of us, to take a look at what our generation needs are for the next 10, 20, 30 years, but also to take a look at our transmission needs. So the question or your statement goes to a lot of things, and I'm happy to comment on any specific questions as well as our staff.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question just regarding the savings that you've realized and achieved. And I'm just wondering if those have been achieved through efficiency or decline in business growth over the past few years.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, could you clarify which savings you're referring to? Where? I think you're referring to the efficiency savings, but we also talked about savings in terms of our, you know, our staff time and how much we've reduced rates.
No, this
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be on page 10, the top slide. Well, both slides.
Commissioner Rothman.
This is the conservation improvement area.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Deputy Commissioner Grant.
And Representative, these are the savings associated with the programs that the conservation improvement programs that utilities have offered their customers. These are the savings that result from more efficient appliances that utilities offer rebates for insulation services that gas utilities offer customers help with. So these are the savings directly attributable to the conservation programs that those companies all have offered.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you. It's actually a different question altogether, but then if we go back to page 12, those slides, the state energy program, grants and so forth, I noticed that there have been 100 to 200 jobs created in the last three quarters, and I'm just wondering what the average length of time for those jobs is. Is that full-time for the full year? I guess for the last three quarters, or is that for those more temporary?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lefebvre, or Commissioner Rothman.
Well, if we know, we'll,
He's a real big source of information, so I'd be surprised if Mr. Lefebvre doesn't have the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you said a real big, I wasn't sure where we were going to go with that.
I was not referring to the length of your hair.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr.
We both have long hair, and that's okay.
You do. Mine's a little.
Someday mine's going to be as long as yours.
And mine's going to be shorter than yours. thank you, Mr. Chair. The reference to 100 to 200 jobs is within each of the way the feds ask us to count jobs is within each of those quarters. That's FTE, so it would be full time within that period. So in the last quarter of calendar 2010, that would have we would have counted enough hours to represent, you know, 100 to 200 actual full time jobs.
Follow up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lefebvre, that's kind of a broad spectrum. I mean, if you can count 200 jobs, you can certainly break it down more specifically. Why the large gap there?
Mr. Lefebvre.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I believe because we're trying to characterize that this does move over time. So for last quarter, I could go back and get you a specific number. But it is not as opposed to weatherization, which has been a more level plane of activity, there's been some variation in employment and activity in SEP.
Representative Scott, does that answer your question, or do you need more?
I'd like specifics.
Okay. Mr. Lefebvre, if you could get us a little more information along those lines, or Commissioner, and just send it forward to the committee, and then we'll get it to the members. Representative Knute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I'd like to compliment the agency. Over the last few years, they've gotten a huge amount of investment in renewable energy through the federal government and really had to ramp up a lot. And it's really exciting for me to see the numbers of Minnesotans served and an effective use of this money, and particularly in reducing energy use. And I think conservation is one of the best ways to avoid having to build really huge new baseload power plants that are not as cost effective as basically not spending money unnecessarily on either heat or electricity. Well, electricity for the baseload power. And the question I have is, Commissioner, you talked a little bit about the LIHEAP money probably being reduced over the last. You might want to stay, I think. The question I have is, what relationship do you see between the ARRA money and the energy efficiency work done related to LIHEAP, and how do those trade off? Do you expect to see savings for some of the families that may be using LIHEAP, and has any of that been quantified?
Commissioner Rothman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we can try and take a stab at that. The programs, as you know, are independent of each other. The LIHEAP money is really meant to get spent, and it goes to help families who need, you know, that stuff. Can we have those savings? I don't know. Maybe we can have Janice just help.
If you could identify yourself for the record, then maybe you could expand on Representative Knute's question.
Thank you, Chair McNamara. My name is Janet Streff. I manage the State Energy Office. We receive the Weatherization Assistance Program receives 5% of the funding each year that comes from LIHEAP. So we use that in addition, but the LIHEAP program as well puts a certain amount of their funding to helping with energy-related repairs. I think because of some of the budget issues at the federal level as well, they're looking at a reduction not only in the low-income energy assistance program, we're looking at a possible reduction in the amount of weatherization assistance program money that we're going to be receiving as well. So we will continue to do as much as we can, but I think there's a real possibility that both of those programs will receive reduced funding in the coming years.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, thanks for coming forward and bringing your folks with today. We appreciate it, and we'll continue. Representative Knute, where are you done? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not surprised that they'd be both programs would be reduced. I'm just sort of curious what the relationship is if we're, you know, weatherizing houses over time. Ideally, they'll be using, you know, 30% less energy, and that, you know, would over time reduce our amount of need for ongoing LIHEAP money. And so I was just curious if there's any relationship looked at there.
Commissioner, Representative Knuth, we have received reports just recently from our agencies that even though they received this huge influx of money from the stimulus funding, that their numbers of households that come and apply for energy assistance and then they are eligible for weatherization has not particularly been going down. So while we may be making more houses energy efficient, there seem to be other homes that come forward.
Thank you. Representative Wiginia.
Thank you. Representative Knuth brings up an excellent question. And maybe it would be helpful, not now, but in the future for us to understand how much total savings could be had from all of our housing stock being really well insulated. And I would say I don't know which portion of housing stock in all of Minnesota does not meet current energy standards, but I suspect it's a fairly large percentage. And so if we were to look at that large percentage as it getting everybody up to current standards, thereby reducing that much energy, it would be, I think it's something we will need to achieve, so we need to know what that number is so we can measure how we're doing. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Rothman.
And Representative, I absolutely agree. It is a significant question, so we'll take that back and take a look at it.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And we can have continuing dialogue.
We appreciate you coming in this morning.
Absolutely.
Early morning. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Next we're going to hear House File 16. Representative Hackbart's got House File 16. We're going to lay it over for possible inclusion in a omnibus game and fish bill. So, Representative Hackbart, if you want to begin that presentation. Representative Hackbart, do we actually go through the formality to move your bill, even though it's for information? We don't, do we? Thank you. I think what we'll do, members, in regards to, we're going to first hear two-line fishing, and then we're going to hear three different bills that deal with northern pike and spearing, and I think what we'll do when we get to those, we'll probably hear from the authors of all three bills and then hear from folks that have comments. So, Representative Hackbart, we'll first deal with two-line fishing, and folks, some of the people that have comments, I think, may comment on both bills, but we'll hear in regards to two-line fishing first. Representative Hackbart.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think I'll make my presentation on the two-line fishing bill and the various spearing bills that we're going to be hearing today all at one time, and I would take questions. The two-line fishing issue has been around for a number of years. I first got involved with this because a constituent of mine, a guy by the name of Ed Fiore, who is in Florida right now and would love to be here and testify, but Ed Fiore is a longtime constituent. He actually talked me into running for the state legislature, and he's really responsible for me being here, so you can blame him. I wish he could be here so you could comment. But Mr. Ed Fiore is a fisherman, and he loves to fish, and he travels a lot. Just about every state he goes to, he can use two lines to fish. He thinks it's ridiculous to not be able to fish in Minnesota with two lines. He lives on Coon Lake in my district in East Bethel, and But Mr. Ed Fiore is not the only constituent I have that supports this. I have a number of constituents since I've been carrying this legislation that also support it. Very, very few people have ever come to me and said, don't do this. You'll see that there's a number of groups out there that do not support two-line fishing. Consequently, some of those same groups are some of the same groups that don't support the spearing legislation that you'll see, too. As you know, I've carried a number of bills connected with game and fish and outdoor recreation, and I see hunting and fishing and snowmobiling and ATVing and horseback riding and all those things as fun things to do, things that the state of Minnesota offers our residents and our non-residents. I think it's part of our heritage. I fully believe in the right to hunt and fish, and that amendment that Senator Lessard brought forward, and I was a huge supporter of. We're going to hear from groups today that are opposed to both two-line fishing and to these spearing bills, and that's mostly what we're going to hear is opposition to these things. I do have some folks in the audience that will come forward and speak to some of these issues in support, but for the most part, you're going to hear a lot of opposition. And the same groups that are going to come forward and speak in opposition to these bills are groups that I support. I support them and their issues for the most part. But we always have these controversies within the legislature, farmer against sportsman, Republican against Democrats, all those kinds of things. So I must tell you that even though these folks are going to be coming up, good friends of mine, things that I worked on in the past with them to get things done, are now going to be here in opposition to me. So just so you know, I'm here for the right to hunt and fish and for the the opportunity and for the sport of it and for the fun of it, mostly for the fun of it. That's why I do the things I do. That's what why I sit on this committee. I'm here for the fun and the recreation of these recreational opportunities we have in the state of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would take any questions on two-line fishing or spearing, or if you want to move on to testimony, we can do that too. I think some of the folks that are in the audience to speak to not only my bill on spearing, but also on Representative Rukavina's bill, and also Representative Purcell's bill are in the audience, and they can come forward and speak to those issues now.
Well, Representative Hackbart, thank you. Could you just real quickly, your bill is real simple. It just deletes a few lines. We've had a number of two-line fishing, and sometimes it's been fairly involved. What specifically does your bill do in regards to two-line fishing?
Well, members and Mr. Chairman, thank you. The bill just simply says that you can use two lines to fish in the summertime. Right now, you can use two lines to fish in the wintertime. We have two-line fishing in the state of Minnesota, not only in the wintertime, but also on our border waters. The border waters between Wisconsin and Minnesota, you can go to the river and you can fish with two lines. We have it in Minnesota already. You can fish in the wintertime with two lines. So, you know, it's a pretty weak argument, I think, that we shouldn't allow this. You'll hear of a number of different reasons that I'm not going to bring forward, but other people can. Why we shouldn't have it, but I don't know why we shouldn't have it. Every state around us does allow two-line fishing. The bill does not include an extra fee for two-line fishing. There's other states that do not do that. I don't know why we would do that. I think it was a tactic maybe last year to try to get the bill passed last year, and it was in the bill, and it went all the way to the governor. And if it wasn't for another issue that was in the Game and Fish bill that bill got vetoed, we'd have two-line fishing today. But it had an extra fee attached to it. It went through the legislature and with relatively unopposed. So this year it's just allowing summertime fishing on the water, just like we have on our lakes now in the wintertime.
Thank you, Representative Hackbart. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, as I recall, last year's bill actually lowered the limits of some certain species of fish. Does your bill at all address the limits?
No, it does not.
Representative Hackbart, thank you. Why don't we start? Anybody else? Why don't we start in? I've got a list of about four people that would like to comment on Representative Hackbart's bill. First, Paul Perkovich, and then Lance Ness next. Is Paul Perkovich in the audience? Lance, I see you're there. Why don't you come down? I've got after Mr. Ness, I've got John. Oh, Jim is here too. And Jim, I don't want to. Lilithov, formerly with the DNR Fisheries, is he's with you, Mr. Ness? Could you identify both of you? Identify yourselves for the record, and then keep your testimony very short. We have a number of folks, and I want to honor all their wishes to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance and a group called Anglers for Habitat. We'll speak to two lines first. And I have with me Mr. Jim Lilithov. He's our technical chairman of our technical advisory committee. So it's a former DNR's fishery. I'll let him introduce himself in a minute. A little bit about two-line fishing in the Fish and Wildlife Alliance. We also are speaking today for a group called the American Fishery Society. These are the professional managers, hydrologists, biologists, and so forth, that do the studies on fish. And they have told us this is not a good idea, that this could result in increasing mortality of hooking a fish. That's where you hook the fish and release it back to the water. And if it's not done properly, these fish will die. If we double the lines, we double the mortality. So the scientists tell us this is not a good idea. So for that reason alone, we would oppose the two-line fishing bill. For spearing, I'll just quickly touch on spearing too. These are biological issues. The DNR has worked out slot limits to protect a certain class of fish so that we get bigger fish. We want bigger northerns. We'd all like to catch a great big northern. I think you'd all agree with that. So they protect a certain class, a certain size of northerns so that we can get bigger northerns. It's a biological, scientific decision, and we support those decisions. I'll let Mr.
Lilithov.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jim Lilienthal. I'm a former DNR fisheries area supervisor. Spent 38 and a half years before I retired in 2008, involved with fish management in central Minnesota. I've had a long connection with managing northern pike and did an extreme amount of work on developing northern pike regulations and putting those in, working to get those in place in the Little Falls area. My reason for leaving 28 below zero weather up north and coming down this morning is that I feel that these slot bills in particular are becoming very damaging to our management of the resource. The bills do not apparently accept the science, that over 20 years of science and research that have gone into that is the investment by our fisheries experts in developing these regulations. There's been a lot of outreach that's taken place to the spears throughout this last 10 years especially. And my concern is that so much of the focus that's taking place in St. Paul is over spearers' rights rather than looking at the biological issues that are tremendous with northern pike populations. You know, the round table many years ago one of their first sessions was people were complaining about the size of northern pike. And I've fished for close to 60 years. I'm an expert northern pike fisherman. I speared my first northern in the Annandale area on Sylvia Twin when I was about 11 years old, my first over 10 pounds. And my involvement in fisheries has not only working and promoting best management practices in the field on management of northern pike, but we've just seen our pike populations go in the tank with high numbers of small northern pike on many of our lakes, and the limitations that have been put on our management have severely handicapped managers' ability to address some of those problems. And we've got lakes, many lakes out there that we're stocking our expensive walleye fingerlings into that have such high populations of small northern pike that it's diminishing the return that we are getting from this expensive walleye fingerling stocking. My best estimate is that there's probably close to half the lakes that we stock with walleye fingerlings in this state that are impacted by high populations of small northerns, and those lakes aren't even being, a lot of them have no regulations on them whatsoever. The spearing community has close to two-thirds of the water in the state, and again, they represent 1% of the licensed anglers, and they have 97% of the lakes. There's only 3% of the lakes in the state that are regulated. And when that went into effect, it had a huge impact on what we began to see in angler satisfaction. And a recent postcard survey that was done by the Little Falls office to give a rural point of view on this has really demonstrated that spearers were in that survey were using 67% were using lakes that had regulations on them. That was the highest user group in the survey. So the idea that these lakes are restricting access doesn't seem to hold water either. Also, 81% of those are using, in the same survey, were also angling. So they've been given a lot of tools with which to harvest northern pike. They do harvest northern pike, and it's an important segment of the northern pike harvest. So if the bill especially that would eliminate slots for spears could severely damage the gains that have been made for all anglers, and if they are removed, and I'll stop.
Thank you, Mr. Lilienthal. A question either for Mr. Ness. Have you guys done any statewide survey of the angling population to get their feeling for two-line fishing? Is there any data that you or an interest group has done with the rank and file, the what Representative Hackbart and I would call just the regular people, not one that are maybe active in a specific group?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Ness,
of the committee, we have not done an actual paper survey, but every year at the roundtable, and I know that you've been there, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Ness, I wouldn't say that the rank and file anglers or hunters are represented at the roundtable because specifically they're told not to come.
I would agree, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
But
thank you.
I will just say at the roundtable that was debated in what was called the back porch, and a good majority of those folks did not favor two lines. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Ness. Thank you, Mr. Lilienthal. Questions? Thank you to both of you for coming down, especially thank you, Mr. Lilienthal, for your service to the state and driving down on a really cold day. Next, I think we have the Muskie folks. Representative Hackbart, I think we will take your advice and kind of blend this together. Representative Rukavina has come in. Representative Rukavina, why don't you come down quick and explain your bill, and then Representative Purcell, you could just explain yours from your spot there after Representative Rukavina. Representative Rukavina, you do not need to stick around after you explain your bill unless you want to. We're just having an informational hearing about the good, bad, and indifference of northern pike two-line fishing, the great state of Minnesota. Representative Rukavina, welcome.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, and members. It's been a long time since I've been in front of the Natural Resource Committee here, so it's a pleasure to be here. I'll start by confessing I'm not much of a fisherman. My friends let me have a bamboo pole with a little bit of line on it, and that's about it. But I did have some constituents that approached me here in December and asked me to put this bill in because they like the spear and spear fishing, and they brought up to me what is a common sense question, and that's how do you tell, you know, through 2 or 3 feet of water if a northern is 16 inches or 18 inches or whatever. And in fact, on one of the lakes that they had a spear house on, when the game warden came by, they asked him the question, and he said, I agree with you. If you have an accident, just throw the fish back in and kind of hide it under the ice. So, I obviously, there are even game wardens out there that think that this law is a little ridiculous. And, you know, I put the bill in at the request of some of my friends who do spear fishing. A lot of them have been doing it for 2 and 3 generations. I know my cousin, we had an old Italian gentleman that boarded with my Italian grandmother when people had to take in miners up on the Iron Range. And his name was Marino Gelsomini. Marino was like a grandpa to me, and he used to carve those fish decoys, and my cousin took up the sport. And, you know, a lot of them don't get to go out as much as they did, but when they do go out, they're not out there trying to abuse anything. They're out there to catch a spear of fish and bring it home and eat it. And I think this, you know, this law is a little ridiculous, and that's why I brought it forward, members. So that's about the extent of it. Maybe there's a way to allow a change or something where you get one fish in the slot or something if you do it by accident. But to even have our conservation officers think that it's a little absurd, and to suggest that if you have an accident that you just kind of hide it, shows that there needs to be some kind of a change in the current law.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Rukavina? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brickvina, your friends take you fishing, give you a bamboo pole with a string on it.
They tie me to the end of the string, Representative.
I was wondering, they put a hook on her, they put a small piece of dynamite for you. I've heard rumors, so I don't know if you want to talk about that in public or not.
Well, other questions for Representative Brickvina? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, not being familiar with decoy fish, if that's a prevalent practice, couldn't they have the decoy fish be of a certain length to help the fishermen judge size?
Representative Brukovina or Representative Hackbart, are you an expert in fish decoys?
To jig that decoy, that's 20 inches. You probably need about a hole about as big as the room here to see it to an arc.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackbart.
We're going to have some expert decoy folks come up and speak to the bill. Maybe they can answer.
Good. Well, thank you, Representative Rukavina. I'm glad we had the same introduction. It was my Uncle Jerry that my dad wasn't a fisherman, but I can remember specifically him putting the cane pole together and rigging it up for me, and that was my first introduction down at Lake Rebecca, where I spent many winter days spearing fish. So you're somebody who you get right to my heart when you talk about my introduction to the outdoors. It was with cane poles and spearing. And Representative Purcell, you've got Representative Rukavina, have you been?
I just wanted to say that now when you go by Bass Lake on the way to your deer hunting shack, you can go out there and still use that bamboo pole.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thanks, Representative Rukavina. Thanks for stopping by. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are several, I believe three testifiers hopefully they're on your list from my district that have driven the long trek here to testify. So,
well, Representative Purcell, I'm not sure they're on their list, but the committee administrator will check with them. Can you explain your bill just real quickly, and then we'll continue on with the testifiers list? Your bill is specific in nature.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 242, some of you certainly have seen this, that we had it last year, and as Representative Hackbarth spoke to the bill that the omnibus that we had last year, and it was vetoed by the governor. This also was in that omnibus bill, and this principally would lift a ban, approximately a 20-year-old ban, on spearing on the lake, Cass Lake, which is a lake adjacent to the community, the municipality of Cass Lake. And I understand in hearing from folks about the science, and as a science guy myself, certainly there are issues related to how we generate data and evaluate that data regarding the science, but this specifically regards the community of Cass Lake, and I bring this on behalf of my constituents. Folks want to spear in Cass Lake, and I have one constituent that I'm aware of that's contacted me that doesn't like this bill. They want the ban left. The rest of that community, overwhelmingly resort owners, bait shop owners, want this ban removed. And I bring this on their behalf.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Next, we're going to hear from Representative Hackbart. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Could we bring Representative Purcell's constituents up to speak to the issue now?
Yeah, why don't we do that? That's a good idea,
come
Representative
a long
Hackbart.
Ways and they'd like to speak to the issue. They could come forward.
Is there other folks beside Representative Purcell's constituents that have traveled from the outstate? We intend to hear. I know the interest groups, the Muskie folks, are here. I see Mr. Inus and the other Muskie folks. Is there anybody else that's traveled from outstate that we haven't heard yet? I think we're going to have time to hear from everybody, including the agency. But I want to, if you folks could identify yourself for the record, and if you could keep your testimony short, and if you would not repeat if one of the previous ones makes a point, that'd be great. Go ahead and welcome to the committee, and thanks for driving down.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Randy Ellis. I'm 52 years old, been living in Cass Lake all my life. Just a little short deal of the history of spearfishing around that town. My dad and Leroy Ellis, which is my dad's first cousin, which owned Leroy's Minnows, they used to run rental spear houses back in the 60s, early 70s. At that time, I went out fishing with my dad at a real young age, and he took me out. It took us time. It took me a lot of years before I was old enough in order to spear. My dad taught me what the fish were that were legal to spear and stuff. That lesson, as of right now to this day, the Cliff organization has been going around putting up posters around the area to show the difference at all the landings on Cass Lake, all public and private, that shows what the different fish are. I said, by the time I learned to spear, I knew what fish was what. And kind of another thing, a muskie has never been documented speared. They've got a listing here where the 2008-2009, all the tickets or summings, warnings for those years, there's a 0.2%, a 0.3% of anybody, and none for spearing. They were all, the rest of them were all angling violations. So another thing is when my dad did get out of spearfishing, he was out of it due to, he worked for the railroad, and he got the seniority to where he went to work full time. And my brother and another friend of his graduated, so he had no help, so he got out. My cousin, which owned Leroy's Minnows, they ended up getting out of it, but they had the minnow shop, and the one son went to the service, so they just ran the bait business, which they sell decoy sucker minnows. The decoy sucker minnows was a part of the trade. Back then, all there was spear houses on the lakes. There was no angling going on at the time, none whatsoever. And I don't think angling really came around until the later 70s, as far as when they started actually angling. It was, and then it was for perch through the ice. Some of the spear fishermen did came up there with some farmers and stuff that came up from southern Minnesota and western by Boston and stuff, and they were tourists that come up and they speared all the time up there on Cass. They in turn, with spear fishing ain't like nowadays. Now you got these nice fancy houses that everybody can stay overnight. The spear fisherman has to get off and find a motel, a resort. They got to find somewhere to sleep. Back then, them fish houses were small. So they needed to eat. They bought gas. It was good for the community. Regular anglers in the wintertime can put a fish house out on the lake and sleep in it all night long. They don't really have to worry about it. But it's still business because they're buying bait. And when they put the spearing ban on, that's when we kind of lost those fishermen. And they kind of, being they were crop farmers, they just, wintertime was their fishing. So we lost them. The one guy that I know from down in Rochester, or Austin, he said that if we could ever get it back, they'd come back. So, and in the idea when that ban went, that also, as me being a born and raised up there, my friends that are Leech Lake members, that lake was never actually closed to spearing. The Leech Lake members can still spear. All they closed it to was the non-Indians. So the lake was never really a true ban. And you know, they've had these little surveys for Sioux Muskie Inc. where these lakes like Bemidji, Plantagenet, all of those lakes are stocked lakes. In 2009, they had fish, the 50-inch club. And Big Lake, which is a banded, or a, it's a closed lake. Nobody can spear on that one. And they had three in the 50-inch club. Cass Lake that year, which is a banned lake in 2009, had five. Leech Lake, which allows spearing, they had seven. Plantagenet allows spearing. They were a stocked lake. They had nine. Lake Bemidji with stocked lake and spearing on it, they had 12. The Muskie Tournament they had last year, a big one. Big Lake had one 50-incher come out of it. Bemidji had four. And Leech Lake had one come out of it. There was two other 50-inchers, but they weren't. And Plantagenet wasn't in their tournament last year. So, kind of in my idea, you know, those lakes that are stocked or stuff for producing the fish, what they did is they basically separated. My partner can go out there and spear on Cass Lake. I want to see it where I can go back out and spear on that lake with him and be legal to do it without, you know. And then the idea of when they put this ban on the lake, this ban wasn't for northerns. This ban was strictly because they're saying we were spearing muskies.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. Yep. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Vaughn. I'm here actually wearing several hats today. I'm a member of the CLIFS organization, the Cass Lake Initiative for Spearing, and it was members of our group that initially contacted Representative Purcell and last year Senator Olson to bring this bill before the legislature. I'm also a newly elected member of the Cass Lake City Council. I'm an attorney practicing in the country for in this city for years, and I've also had I've been a lifelong spearer. I'm also here today to speak a little bit with regard to the business community in Cass Lake. Unfortunately, because of the short notice, the mayor of Cass Lake would have been here, but he is currently meeting with the MPCA with regard to the Superfund site. The members of the Chamber of Commerce are preparing for one of their major events of the year, which is a fishing tournament this weekend. So I'll speak in relatively broad terms to a number of issues. First of all, from an economic standpoint, Cass Lake is in an area that is extremely economically depressed, and we rely heavily on tourism. There's very little for fishing and lake tourism in the wintertime. In the past, there have been, as Randy mentioned, a number of people who would come to the area to spear. That is no longer available. We have had this kind of started because a member of a local bait shop and a resort owner that rented fish houses began being contacted in the last few years from a number of groups asking to come and rent houses there and said, well, can we spear on this lake? And when they were told no, they didn't come. They said, we want a lake that we can spear or angle on. And they said, as soon as the lake is open, we'll come. Now, I'm not going to tell you that spearing on Cass Lake is going to solve all the economic woes of our community. Certainly it will not. But frankly, in today's climate and in the economic conditions of our city, the opportunity to have any business there in the wintertime is certainly beneficial to our community and the businesses that are located there. I do want to speak a little bit to the study that was done that originally started this ban in 1988. When you look at the results of the spearing ban, the report that was generated at the end, the one of the things that really is to me, frankly, a bit offensive is, as a sportsman, the very premise of this is that there is illegal activity occurring. You know, that's kind of like saying that the decreased moose population in northeastern Minnesota is due to deer hunters shooting moose either because they're too ignorant to know the difference or because they're just outlaws who do it on purpose. If a crime is being committed, enforce the laws on the books. It's illegal to spear muskies. If accidents are happening, then that's a result of education. And that's, as Randy mentioned, the signs we're putting up, we're increasing education to try and help people know the difference. But the fact is that there's a mortality rate from catch and release fishing. Even if there was a few accidental spearings, that mortality rate compared to what's happening from angling is really not even close. One of the things in the enabling statute that refers to this, that brought on this experiment, there's a very specific clause in there that says that after the 10-year experimental period, if the ban is to be made permanent, the commissioner was required to provide findings that there was a connection between the experimental policies and an increase in muskie fishing. But what's interesting is that in the December 1st, 1997 report, the statement that's made is, although we cannot quantify why muskie populations increased in Cass Lake, they still suggested it be closed. This clearly demonstrates that this did not comply with the law. It was not able to show a direct connection between spearing and the muskie population. I do want to mention this book that I picked up in Cass Lake is a book called Netting Real Memories. It's written by a gentleman by the name of Merv Heitschmidt. His family owned a resort on Cass Lake, and Merv was a guide on Cass Lake for many, many years. This is a beautiful book that talks about the history of fishing on Cass Lake, and particularly muskie fishing. And one of the things that I find very interesting is, in this book, Merv talks about, you go back to the 90s, or the 50s, and he talks about catching 30, 40 fish in a summer, muskies. These are not catch and release. These are boated fish that are caught, taken out of the lake. That was the policy. And one of the things that I just wanted to read to you something that it's a passage from the book.
Mr. Vaughn, I'm going to need you to wrap it up here.
I will do that, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
And I find this very telling, is that he talks about the fact that I can't help but have a little remorse about our policies at that time of taking the biggest fish and leaving the smallest one go. The truth is that the reason that the muskie populations are increasing is due directly to muskie fishermen. In the 70s, there was a quantum shift in the mentality of fishermen. Anglers stopped catching the biggest fish, taking them off and putting them on their walls. They started catch and release programs, and they started educating their fellow anglers not to keep the biggest fish. And that, in fact, is the factor that has affected muskie populations, not the ban on spearing. Lifting this ban would be a benefit to the people of Cass Lake, and it would not be, and the science that was behind it does not really support that ban. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. Mr. Vaughn, questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ellis, Mr. Vaughn, thanks for coming. I represent one of those districts in southern Minnesota that you talk about, just north of Rochester. Many of those farmers have talked to me and urged me to support this bill. I will sign on to Representative Purcell's bill. I want to thank you for coming and sharing this with us today, and have a safe trip back.
Thank you, Representative.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming. I think next, why don't we hear, I think there's a couple more folks from the Dark House Association. I thought I saw them here. Once you guys come down, let's do you, and then I know there's some folks here from Muskie Alliance and Muskie Inc., and then there may be some citizens. And welcome to the committee. Welcome back, I guess, again.
Thank
and
you.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Heschel. I'm a member of the Minnesota Dark House and Angling Association.
Hey, Roger, could you pronounce your last name again?
Geschel.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Geschel, go ahead.
I want to testify on House File 225, the Northern Pike reducing the slot limits down to 60 lakes. I've been around working, you know, in and out with the DNR for in excess of 20 years. I know the history of the Cass Lake situation very well, probably more than other than a couple of the guys maybe from the DNR. But I want to talk about this bill. Back a number of years ago, I went to the DNR, I went to Ron Pyer, who was fisheries chief, and I suggested to Ron that perhaps we should have a few, possibly up to 20 lakes that we could use for trophy lakes in the state of Minnesota, where we could use those like they did in Canada. We had a long conversation. I said it'd be kind of tough to just say total catch and release because there's a lot of cabins on those lakes, and maybe those people didn't want to do that exactly like that. But I said we should look at maybe having up to 20 lakes. He said, it sounds interesting. He said, I'll get back to you. So a few weeks later, he got back to me, and he said, I talked to Jack Wingate, who was in the DNR and fisheries over there, and he said, we thought probably 30 to 36 lakes would be more like it, because we took a real study, and 30 to 36 lakes seemed appropriate. I said, okay. So he said, we'll work on this and get back to you. Number of months later, he called and we said, we're going to send out a press release in another week, but I wanted to give you a heads up and tell you which lakes, and we've come up with 60. I said, where did the 60 come from? We started at 20, and you said 30, 36. But he said, well, we had everybody in, and 60 was a number that we decided upon. And they put this out in a press release a week later, all of the names of the lakes. We then had the DNR roundtable in January. We got up, and at that time, Mr. Pyer got up, and he said, we're coming out with what we call a toolbox regulation. And he explained this, and he said, we've gone and we've done with Northern Pike, we're doing 60 lakes where we're regulating for trophy Northern Pike. And so he said, we're all done with Northern Pike. We've got 60 lakes. Now he explained how we're going to do this. We're going to go to panfish, and we're going to go to walleyes and so on. But we're all done with Northern Pike. And one of the other fellows that was working with the DNR at the time, I mentioned to him, I said, I wouldn't bet on it that we're done with Northern Pike. There are people over there who informed me, and I talked to them today, and they've informed me that there's a number of people over there that don't like spearing, and there's a lot of them that do. And he said, it's one, make you aware of that. So anyway, now the number after that, a couple years later, starts going up and up and up, where, oh, we're adding more lakes and more lakes that you can't spear on. Well, not that you can't, but we have these regulations. And basically what that regulation is, for the majority, is from 24 to 36. That means any northern pike between 24 and 36 inches, you can't take. Anything under, they're suggesting, anything under 24, you can keep. Well, I said, you know, under 24, you can't feed those to your family. They're full of bones. That's, they're, you know, nobody wants to eat them. Well, you can pickle them. Well, how many pickled fish can you eat a week? You know, your kids don't want them. So anyway, basically what happens is those lakes are off limits. You might as well forget them. So those lakes are out. Now we're up to 120 some. Plus the 27 lakes where you can't spear at all, we're pushing probably 150 lakes. And I know Mr. Lilienthal talked here a minute ago about how people were taking fish off of there. In his area, there are very few, before he left, there are very few lakes left that you can, where you know, people can go and spear on and actually take a fish. Usually when they put a restriction on, spearing is over with because the guys won't go on there. As Mr. Ruccovina talked about, representative, up in his area, the people that do, a couple of them, and Representative Anzell last year put a bill in. A couple of his constituents up there and friends were checked, and they had a northern that was, you know, right around 24. Well, when it was checked, it was a little bit over, eighth of an inch, a quarter over. They got a big fine, and it's on your record. $100-some fine, it's on your record for that big. So basically, you're losing out on a lake. So what I would like to see is that we hold the DNR to their promise, that 60 lakes, for 10 years, and let's see. Now, I know that some of these, I was in this ESOSID group for a couple years, and they say, well, it's working. After 10 years, a lake has gone up maybe 2 inches in size. That's not very good. Well, we need another 10 years. So how long are we going to keep these on? Let's take 60 lakes and leave it at that for 10 years and let them pick the 60 out of the 100 and some they have. Take their best shot. Let's see what happens in 10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Cashel. If you could identify yourself for the record, and if you have something more to add, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Tim Spreck. I'm president of the Minnesota Dark House Angling Association, and I will amend my comments as I'm working here so as not to be redundant, so bear with me.
We appreciate that. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm going to make some comments initially with regard to the reducing this lakes with slot limits to no more than 60. The thing that we need to look at here is a broad overview of how the DNR manages pike in the state of Minnesota. Currently, they're managing with one goal in mind, and that is to produce trophy fishery for tourists and moneyed elites. What they've done in the process is they've forgotten about us, the little guys, the people that pay the taxes, the people that swing the hammers out in the countryside, that are looking for an opportunity to put some fish on the table for dinner. We want to make sure that our concerns are addressed. Our organization represents literally thousands of hardworking men and women throughout the state of Minnesota that are interested not in a fish for the wall, but a fish for the table. A couple comments about the science related to the slot limits for pike. We need to understand that there is quite a bit of science behind this, but it's not the kind of science that you've heard previously today. The thing that we need to understand is that in order for a lake to have the ability to produce a trophy pike, it needs to possess the following characteristics. It has to have room within the biomass structure of the lake. That means that a lake can only hold so many pounds of fish, and when it's full, you can't add anymore. You also need to have depth, you need to have forage, and you need to have genetics. And if those things do not exist, trophy pike will not be produced, no matter how hard you try or how much you limit our ability to harvest the fish. One thing that I would comment is that recently the DNR brought forward a proposal to increase the upper end of the slot on Upper Red Lake to 44 inches. Now, in that particular instance, we did not oppose that because we understand that based on science and data and what people are telling us, that Upper Red Lake does have the possibility and the probability that it can produce large trophy pike over 40 inches. We did not oppose that because it made sense. And in our proposal, Upper Red Lake, along with a few other lakes that the DNR may have sound scientific data on, should be included within the 60. We have no problem with that. We're reasonable people, and we understand that we can manage for both. We can manage for trophy pike status to bring in the tourist dollars, and we can also manage for the little guy and his grandson or his son or daughter and wife to go out and fish and provide a meal for his family. So those are my main comments. I would be able to comment more about the science if you have questions. Now, with regard to Cass Lake, I think the folks from Cass made a very compelling case and did an excellent job, so I will not comment further on things that they've covered. But I think it's important that we understand that, once again, this is about opportunity. There is no documented cases where people have speared muskies illegally statewide, so that's not an argument that holds any water. I want to leave you with one final quote, a closing quote, as we wrap up our testimony today. A while back, there was a TV news story, and a man made a comment on that TV news story on KSTP News, and he said the following: "Every lake in this country is public, and I have as much right to that lake as anyone else does." And we agree with that statement. It's all about opportunity. The thing that we find most interesting about that is the man that made that statement is in the room today, and his name is Sean Kellett. He's one of the proponents for Muskies, Inc., and the Muskie Alliance, who would like to limit our ability to spearfish on Cass Lake.
Thank you, Mr. Spreck and Mr. Gischel. Any questions? Thanks, guys. Next is Mr. Kim, a citizen in the... Would you come forward, and if you could just limit your testimony to 1 or 2 minutes and let us know your thoughts, concerns, I'd appreciate that. If you could identify yourself for the record.
My name is Rob Kim. I live in St. Paul. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your time. I will keep my comments brief. One thing that we've heard a number, and I'm speaking specifically to the lifting of the slot limits for speared lakes on all lakes with slot limits for pike, and the reducing the number of lakes with pike regulations to 60. I have a couple of thoughts on that, or a couple of points I want to make. Something you've heard a number of times from supporters of these two bills is the word opportunity. And the idea that somehow by managing a fishery for something other than unfettered harvest, you are limiting the opportunity to use that resource. But the reality is, if you're a spearer, you have ample opportunity in the state of Minnesota to spear, including on lakes that have slot limits for pike. As you probably heard already, spears represent 1% of the licensed anglers in the state of Minnesota. That 1% has basically unlimited access without slot limit regulations beyond the statewide limits to 97% of the lakes in the state of Minnesota that have populations in northern pike. So let me say that again, 1% of the licensed anglers, they have unrestricted access to 97% of the state's lakes. Okay? So that seems to me to be pretty ample opportunity to spear.
Anything else, Mr. Kim?
Yes. The lakes that do have slot limits, setting aside the 27 lakes that have a spearing ban for completely different reasons, there is not a ban on spearing on a lake because it has a slot limit for northern pike. What there is the same rules that 99% of the other anglers in the state have to follow. If a pike falls in between the in the slot limit, it's protected from harvest. Harvest is blind to method. If someone catches a pike during the summer and kills it, that's a pike taken out of the population. If somebody spears it during the winter, that's a pike taken out of the population. And those slot limits are in place to protect that segment of the population. But supporters of this bill and these bills and opponents of the pike regulations will tell you that if there are slot limits on a body of water, that places some kind of extraordinary burden on dark house spears that they can't use, that it's something unique and something out of the ordinary and, in fact, something discriminatory. The reality is we place these kinds of restrictions on Minnesota sportsmen and women in all kinds of other contexts. If you're a deer hunter and you don't have a doe tag, you better make a discretionary judgment on whether the horns on a spike buck are more than 3 inches long. If they're under 3 inches, it's illegal. It's the same thing with a northern pike that's speared inside or outside the slot. In the past, we've asked hunters to know the difference between a redhead and a canvasback. We asked them to know the difference between a hen mallard and a black duck. What we're asking in applying these slot limits is for every angler, regardless of the method they use, to apply discretion in their sport.
Thank you, Mr. Kim.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's have the Muskie folks come down. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Okay, Muskies, why don't you both come down, Minnesota Muskie Alliance and Minnesota or Muskies Inc., if you can both come down, and the group who's ever going to speak. I'm going to give you about 8 minutes to do your thing, and then I'm going to have to cut you off because I have to allow some time for the DNR to speak. So just be cognizant of that, if you would. Please identify yourself for the record and welcome.
Sean Kellett, Muskies Incorporated.
A little bit slower, Sean.
I'm sorry. Sean Kellett, Muskies Incorporated.
Thank you.
John Underhill, Chairman of the Minnesota Muskie Alliance.
Go ahead, gentlemen.
Speaking on the two line. In the past, when we've heard the talk about the economics and that sort of thing. Minnesota draws a tremendous amount of people here, and tourism, some of these people were also referred to as elites. I'm not sure what that is, but we need to maintain that, and we maintain those people coming and people buying licenses every year by maintaining the quality of the fishery. The reason that Minnesota draws those people is because of what we have. Minnesota is not Wisconsin, North Dakota, or South Dakota, or Iowa. We have something very special here. The DNR has also expressed in past testimony here on this two-line that it would be an increase of 30 to 50% from the research they've done on the border waters where you can have two-line. That would be an additional million northern pike removed from the state, million walleyes, 1,200,000 pounds. If you went at 30%, 19 million panfish. We've already got problems with small panfish in a lot of lakes, and adding this burden of this extra line, I don't see it as a way to sustain our fishery long term, and I don't think a lot of the anglers are going to be acceptable of having their bag limits lowered by 30 or 50% to maintain the quality of Minnesota fishery. It seems like it's more of a gimmick to keep things or to try to draw more interest or appease a small amount of people. Leading into the slots, the slots are put there to protect medium-sized fish. The 24 to 36 is for maintaining quality fish in that breeding size, and it's not a trophy regulation. Trophy regulations are regulations that protect pike over 40 inches. So the comments where northern pike are trophies at 36, that's not correct. The economics of it are very visible when you get to areas like Red Lake, the people up there have fought very hard to keep and maintain their large pike up there. There's a few lakes in the state where you do get big pike. Cass Lake is one of those lakes. Vermilion has some big pike. Some of the Lake of the Woods. Northern pike are long-lived fish, so it takes a long time to study them. And I know that's frustrating. That it takes 20 years or 15 years to do research on a fish that lives 25 years or 20 years. But that's the length of time required to do these studies. And I'm one of those farm kids from Moore County. I was born and raised southern Minnesota. Many family members were spearers. Some of my earliest memories were in a spear house. I'm definitely not an anti-spearing person. Probably every person that is here speaking on, I know, Sean, he's dark house speared. It's not an anti-spearing issue. It's about taking accountability for your impact. Simply because there's 1% of the licensed anglers are dark house spearers, it doesn't reflect the impact that they have.
Mr. Kellett, I got to tell you, there's only a couple minutes left, and I do want to give Mr. Underhill a chance to speak. I'm assuming he has something to say.
I'm Mr. Kellett.
Oh, I got you backwards. Mr. Okay. Underhill, I got you backwards. But go ahead, if you would, please.
22% of the northern pike harvested are from...
If you're going to come into the committee, you got to be quiet, guys. Thanks. Go ahead, Mr. Underhill.
22% of the northern pike harvested by weight are harvested by 1% of the anglers. So
thank you.
That's why we have to have continuity with the regulations, both summer and winter and ice. The Cass Lake issue.
I got to be honest. There's about 1 minute left for the two of you.
Oh, go ahead, Sean.
Thanks, John. I'll be as brief as I can. Sean Kellett, thank you, Mr. Chair. To dispel a myth as well, I'm not anti-spearing. My father-in-law spears, makes for some great holiday dinners. I won't lie to you there. And I'm also not just a muskie angler. I've caught over 30 different species of fish just in the last 3 years alone in three different countries. I'm here as an advocate for the fishery. And quite frankly, these bills, the two-line bill, the pike bills, and the cast bill, none of which are going to improve the fishery. I helped actually destroy a crappie fishery with me and my family in Green Lake when I was a child. It was during that time that I actually learned the hard way what it was to be a conservationist of the fishery. We used to take 5 gallon buckets of crappies out of Green Lake. I mean, we used to go there in the morning, then we used to go in there in the afternoon, we used to go there in the evening, taking a limit each time and eating them each time. After 5 years of that, there's no more fish. We wondered why. Well, we figured out why. Because you have to have accountability for the resource. There's only so many fish in these lakes, and we have to realize that. Speaking to Mr. Spreck, who so eloquently quoted me from the TV, everyone does have a right to these lakes. And here's the issue with Cass Lake, is that... That is a naturally reproducing lake. We do not stock one single walleye, one single muskie, anything. We do not stock that lake. What happens when you take the large pike out of any natural system is that the natural reproduction of muskies is greatly inhibited. We're finding this out even in our stocking programs in lakes that have an overabundance of small pike, that the fingerling stocking does not work. We're midway through a study right now on Lake Minnetonka, White Bear Lake, and Bald Eagle Lake here in the metro. We're experimenting with stocking different sizes of muskies to see if our yield becomes better. If the spearing ban is lifted on casts, those large pike will be taken out of there. I don't care what anybody says. That is the history of what has happened any time that spearing is allowed on a water that has a lot of large northern pike on it. As you heard from the testimony of the spearers, they are against slot limits as well. So if the pike have no protection whatsoever, these muskies are not going to be successfully reproducing, and therefore the muskie fishery on that lake will be going downhill steadily from the second that this spearing ban is lifted until we actually wake up and see what's happening here. As far as the economics, I guess one quick thing. They're saying how it's a boon to their economy. I have a study in front of me done by the states in 1985, and spearing activities ranked just above power boating and just under swimming as far as a local economic impact, and it represented a 1.35% of the total outdoors spend in that area. And that was in 1985, when there's twice as many spears as there are today.
Okay, thank you. If we could have the DNR come down. Mr. Bogus, if you could give us your thoughts on this wide range of things that have been before us, both on two line and spearing. You want to do one at a time?
Maybe, Mr. Chair.
If you want to do them together, do however you want.
For the record, Ed Bogus, Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. I think I'm going to just hit kind of the three issues that you're dealing with real quickly. I've got Dirk Peterson with me, our Chief of Fisheries, who's distributing some background information for the committee. I understand you don't have very much time, so we're going to try to leave you with some data and some background and then hit the high points. But just as some introductory remarks on the two line issue, Minnesota for open water fishing has had one line regulation since 1920. So we've had 90 plus years of one line for fishing. Our whole regulatory structure for fishing has been designed around a one line fishery. We have data from border waters where we do allow two lines that indicates that a third of the anglers or so would likely use two lines if they could, and that it would significantly increase harvest in the range of 20% or so, and Mr. Peterson can talk more about that. So the point is that we've developed a quality fishery with a variety of regulations under one line system. If we have a two line system, obviously other states have two line systems, we could adjust our regulations to accommodate that, but it's going to be more restrictive regulations, limits, slots, things like that, or we're going to see a decline in the quality of the fishery. On northern pike, in general, we've got a couple of bills that deal generally, and then we have Cass Lake, which is more of a specific situation. But on the northern pike issue, the special and experimental regulations take a long time to take effect because northern pike grow slow. We're trying some quality management with deer now where, we've got some antler point restrictions that are experimental, and we know we can perhaps have some results in 3 to 5 years. But with these fish populations, it takes literally a generation to affect that fishery to the point that you have quality fish. So exempting anybody from the size limits, the slot limits, will essentially negate those regulations and make them, there would be no point in continuing those regulations if everybody didn't have to follow them. On the number of lakes, I know I've spoken with Mr. Geschel a number of times, and he certainly believes there were some commitments made in the past. We've gone through an extensive planning process on esophids, which is northern pike and muskies, to create a plan for limiting the number of lakes to 125, which is a small percentage of the 3,300 or so northern pike lakes that we have in the state. We would like to continue to work with him and the Dark House folks, but when we did those lakes, we went through an exhaustive process of posting and public comment, and there was very strong interest in those lakes. And if we have to get rid of half of them, there's going to be a lot of the constituents that use those lakes that want those regulations that are not going to be very happy. And then finally on Cass, just to say that that spearing ban was originally for muskie. It was a contentious issue. We did renew the experimental reg and make it permanent. That's our rule. We support that rule. But In looking at what's happened since that ban went into effect in the late 1980s, it really has probably had a greater impact on northern pike. It was done for muskies, but the likely impact of removing it will be a decline in the quality of northern pike. So that's I've left Mr. Peterson a few minutes. If he could just talk about some of the data that's in the handouts, Mr. Chair.
I would argue whether...
Thank you, Director Boggess. Mr. Peterson, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dirk Peterson. I'm the Fisheries Chief for Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And I would argue how many minutes Mr. Boggess has left me. But anyway, if you were to take a quick look at the fact sheet or the background information that deals with fishing with two lines, and the graphic on the back shows some fishing contest records from north central Minnesota that shows past World War II we had a general decline in quality of fishing with the increase in angling. And by the time we reached the late 1980s, there were a lot of concerns around the state that we'd become a state of quarter pounders and potato chips, if you will, and that led to the first roundtable. And over the last 20 years, we've worked with roundtable participants to bring back some of the quality fishing that we had in the past. There are two examples below on Winnebagoches where we've increased with protected slot limits. We've increased the frequency you might catch a walleye greater than 19 and a half inches, sixfold. Another example is smallmouth in the Mississippi, where there's a fourfold increase in your chance of catching that 12 to 20 inch fish. We have some limited information about two-line fishing from border waters, as has been mentioned previously. Some good information we have is from Big Stone Lake on the South Dakota border, where we did find 30% of the anglers chose to use two lines in that walleye fishery, and those 30% anglers increased the harvest by 39%. And the overall fishery, when you take in the balance of the anglers, of 20%. From our perspective, if you apply that to the walleye fisheries around the state, including our large lakes, Mille Lacs, Leech, Lake of the Woods, Red, whatever you wish to call it, to achieve and maintain the same quality that we have on our lakes, we would probably have to propose a rule that would reduce the bag limit to 2. To increase the harvest savings to maintain the current quality that we've achieved over the last 20 years. And there's probably a number of anglers who would not find that to be an acceptable change in trade for a two-line regulation. The other more stringent example is where we have shared harvest of our walleye populations, like on Mille Lacs and Red Lake, where we share that with the bands, and on the border waters where we share harvest with the provinces of Ontario and Manitoba. We would, in the Mille Lacs case, reducing the bag and having two lines out there might lead to reductions in bag, and also less prediction as to how mid-season corrections in the protected slot limit would take place.
Hey, Chief Peterson, if I could follow up, we're going to have to cut you off. Would you say that you're going to lower the fishing limit on Mille Lacs if two-line fishing is allowed?
That would be one of the tools we would have to employ to make sure we stay within the safe harvest limits.
Thank you, Chief and Director Boggess. Thank you. I want to allow enough time for Representative Hackbarth. Do you have comments on members? We will have this issue back before us. Director Boggess, you will get an opportunity to speak again. I'm sure there'll be questions from the members for that. Members, we have the minutes of the meeting of February 9th. Representative Drazkowski, you want to move the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, move to approve the minutes of February 9th.
Representative Drazkowski moves the minutes of February 9th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion carries. Meeting adjourned.